So everyone who has been house shopping recognizes the importance of very carefully examining the seller disclosure. Recognizes the importance of combing through that paper that the seller provides that talks about all of the past issues of your home. And everyone who has ever sold a home likewise knows the importance of very carefully and yet accurately describing the issues that your home has experienced and trying to paint them in the most positive light possible to the potential buyer of your home. And the truth is this, that a home that has been up for any amount of time is going to have had some issues and had some work that's been done to it. And so there's a level of work and improvement that you almost want to see in a home, to see that the people who are there took care of it. There are lots of acceptable things that you could read on a seller disclosure, but there are some things that would cause us pause. You know, it's acceptable. You could expect when you're looking at a disclosure to have something like, you know, water in a basement. That's something that lots of homes deal with. But if you read on the disclosure that there's some kind of a recurring mold problem, it would cause you pause. You know, you might be fine with reading something about sort of an ant infestation or something like that. You might not be. But you'd probably be a lot better with ants than with bats in the attic or something like that. You know, there are some things that are acceptable and some things that are unacceptable as you're looking through a disclosure like that. And one thing that is pretty universally unacceptable to people when they're looking to buy a home is if they see that there's been some kind of major foundational structural kind of problems that have taken place in a home. That's something that is a tricky thing and that a lot of people don't want to touch, because if your foundation has issues, it can literally, you know, not speaking with exaggeration, it could literally cause your house to collapse. It could literally cause everything else in your house to have issues. And so, you know, a plumbing issue can be fixed by fixing a pipe and patching a hole. But a structural issue, a foundation issue, is something that can be a lot more difficult. And so as we continue looking at the family and issues that affect our family today, we're going to dig in and kind of look at a foundational piece, a foundational issue that affects our family. And as we do that, as we kind of intro this, we're going to look back at America's favorite couple, at Chip and Joanna Gaines. And we're going to watch a clip from them. And this isn't a clip from the show, but this is from an interview that they did that talked about the relationship that they have. And it reveals some important truths about marriages. So we're going to watch that now.
We got married in 2003.
Married in 2003.
We met in 2001. And, you know, I think it's funny because we were polar opposites.
Yeah. We had been brought up in very similar environments. Our parents were both believers, brought up in the church, I'd say is a common way to say that, middle class to some extent. But other than that, I mean, my parents were fairly liberal when it came to, you know, hey, go out on your bike and drive around in the neighborhood for hours. And her parents were like, go out in the backyard, but only as long as you have bubble tape completely around your head, neck, and vital organs.
Tell them the story.
The story is we met in 01, and Chip liked me a whole lot.
Yeah,
he
right.
He kind of scared me. I thought he was somewhat of a stalker. But then I realized he had a really good heart. We dated for a year, and he proposed. We were married a year and a half later. No, we were married for a year.
Baby, you're awful at our love story. Listen, our love story is pretty simple. She saw me. She was completely enamored, for obvious reasons. And I came over to her and I said, listen, what is your sister doing later? And she said, oh, my sister's married. And I said, well, then, fair enough. What are you doing later? And she said, I have no plans because I haven't dated anyone in like 18 years. And I said, well, you're in for the ride of your life, young lady. Are you ready to pony up? And she said, I don't even know what that means, but let's do it. And so the next thing you know, we had four children. And now we're writing basically marriage seminars. We speak on marriage and love love making.
Our short love story, our short story is that we met each other in 2001. We were married in 2003, and from the beginning, I think it was just a fun kind of roller coaster. I was a safe, kind of overprotected child, and Chip was this rowdy, kind of risky guy. And so if you can imagine those two worlds colliding, it was very interesting. But somehow we figured out a way to make that work and have fun with it.
Sure. And I think the one piece of advice that I'd give myself, if I could go back in time and tell myself some piece of advice that would help our marriage, to be honest, it was just the idea that when I learned how to embrace Joanna for who she is and really support her all the way, I feel like that was a real light bulb moment for me in my relationship with her. And ironically, I think that it was a back and forth, you know, as I really enveloped this concept of I'm going to support her and love her and fight for her regardless. I feel like that opened your heart to be able to reciprocate, you know.
So, I mean, they're cute, like I said, and he's a funny guy. But after, you know, kind of that humor, there's almost this point where it seems accidental in a way, because he's so kind of, he's so folksy and funny. It seems accidental when that wisdom kind of falls out of his mouth, where he says if he could go back and describe, you know, a lesson that he would like to learn earlier in marriage. When he talks about that idea of learning what it was like to support and to love his wife and to embrace her for who she was, what we see in that moment, in the midst of all the jokes, is this really foundational piece of what it looks like for us to have healthy, functioning families. And so we're going to kind of dig in to how that idea is sort of a foundational issue that affects families. And if you could not be here last week, we kicked off this series where we're talking about fixing up our families, about remodeling our families, and what that process looks like. And one of the first admissions or acknowledgments that we made last week was that there is no such thing as a perfect family. It just doesn't exist. And if you were here last week, I hope that's something that helped you to breathe a sigh of relief. I hope that's something that brought you a sense of comfort, that even though sometimes in life we have this comparison that pops up. We look at our neighbors, we see how nice their house is, how nice their yard is, we see how nice the things that they have are. We see them and we see, you know, the way that they appear in public to be like the perfect couple, the way their kids are behaved and are high achieving and all of these sorts of things. We're tempted oftentimes to look at other families and think they're perfect and we're less than them. But the truth is that all families have issues that take place, that all families could use a little bit of help in the area of remodeling. And so last week, as we started looking at this, we said, while there's no example of a perfect family that we can look to in a world after Adam and Eve and after the fall, there are certainly biblical ideals that lay out what the family is supposed to look like. And we looked at a passage from the Apostle Paul in Colossians chapter 3, verses 18 to 21. And we're going to just highlight these quickly again. The passage is simple. These are like each a sentence in the passage. If you look at Colossians 3, 18 to 21, we see four ideals that emerge. It talks about wives submitting to their husbands. It talks about husbands loving their wives and not being harsh with them. It talks about children being obedient to their parents. And it talks about fathers going through this effort to be gentle with their children, to not cause them to become embittered in life towards them. And when we think about this passage, and we spoke about this last week, we're not going to dive into this deeply today. It is really quick and apparent that there are one of these ideals that has just fallen way out of popularity or political correctness in the culture in which we find ourselves. The idea of wives being submissive to husbands is something that is a difficult thing for any of us to really talk about with people who are outside of the church, and oftentimes it becomes a difficult, contentious issue to address inside of the church. If any of you had a neighbor who came to you who was not a believer and said, hey, I'm, you know, our marriage is really struggling. Is there anything you can give us? You probably wouldn't start with this idea. This probably wouldn't be the first piece of advice that you would give. It's just something that that is not very popular as we think about the world that we live in and the culture that we live in to even discuss the idea of wives being submissive to husbands. And so what we need to do, what we need to remember is this, that sometimes when we approach a passage, we look at it and we look at it with sort of our cultural lenses. We look at it and we interpret the Bible at times through the culture in which we're living in. And if we do that with this idea and with this passage, what we find is something that feels archaic, that feels old, that feels, you know, out of date and out of touch with the world that we live in. And so oftentimes we can be tempted in that regard to just sort of brush it aside and to ignore it or to kind of sweep it under the rug or to try to act like it's not there or justify why it might not still apply to us today in the world that we live in. But when we do that, we miss a teaching from the Apostle Paul on what the ideal family looks like. And what we see in this passage, if we really dig in and look at the idea of submission, is that this is one place where submission is talked about, but this isn't the only place where submission is talked about in the idea of a marriage relationship or a family relationship. Even less popular than Colossians 3:18 is a passage in Ephesians chapter 5, verse 22. And in that passage, we read, "Wives, submit to your husbands as you do to the Lord." And this is a passage, again, that has fallen and become wildly unpopular in the world that we live in today. And it uses some of that same language in the submission piece. It even kind of takes it a step further to talk about how this submission is an act as you do to the Lord. And so when you think about this idea and the kind of way that describes the marriage relationship, it is something that a lot of people really struggle with. But when we do that, we ignore a lot of what the Bible teaches us and we pull this one passage out of context. Because if we would just look at Ephesians 5:21 and we would begin there, this is what we would read. "Submit to one another out of reverence for Christ." And then he goes on to say, "Wives, submit yourselves to your own husbands as you do to the Lord. For the husband is the head of the wife as Christ is the head of the church, his body, of which he is the Savior." Do you see how easy that is in some regards? If we focus in on one passage and we don't look at it in the context in which it was spoken, it kind of can be twisted and can say something very different than what it's intended to actually say. But when we read through Ephesians chapter 5, when we look at the chapter as a whole, what we see in that section of scripture is that Paul is describing all kinds of different ways that Christians are supposed to live and interact in the world around them. And he's describing things that aren't gender specific, that aren't age specific, that aren't specific to your role, whether you're a mother or a father, a husband or a wife, a child or a parent. He's describing all of these different attributes of what it means to live as a Christian. He tells people that they shouldn't be greedy. He tells people that they should be careful and not speak foolishly to one another. He goes on and he tells people, positive attributes, the way they should act, the fact that we should all live with this level of thanksgiving as we recognize what Christ has done for us. And then, beginning in Ephesians chapter 5, verse 21, he starts in to speak specifically about family roles. And he begins that teaching with the verse, "Submit to one another out of reverence for Christ." That idea of mutual submission is kind of one of the foundations of what it means to live in a healthy Christian family with one another. And it's not just the idea of mutual submission, but it's this idea of mutual submission out of reverence for Christ. And so I think when I read that passage and when I really think about it, I say, you know, the idea of submission is something that a lot of us can understand. The idea of reverence for Christ, having an awe, having a respect for Christ, is something that a lot of us can understand. When we think about who Christ was, we remember him reverently. When we think about who Christ was, we recognize the things that he's done for us, and we're filled with sort of this deep respect for who he is and what he's done. But then when you think about this passage, when you put these ideas together, submit out of the reverence that we have, it asks the question, what does that mean? How do you submit out of reverence? And I think there's a passage in Mark chapter 10 that helps to make this very clear to us. What it means to submit out of reverence for Christ. So if you turn there, we're going to be looking at Mark chapter 10. And there's an exchange that happens in Mark 10, verses 35 to 45. And to give a little backstory before we read that passage, in this passage, what we see is that two of the disciples, James and John, they come to Jesus and they have a question for him. And James and John are referred to kind of in two different ways. Sometimes they're called the sons of Zebedee, to identify who their father was. Sometimes they're called the sons of thunder to identify what their personality was like. And this is definitely a time where even though they're referred to as the sons of Zebedee, you kind of see a boldness in James and John that you don't see oftentimes in life. And so they come to Jesus and they tell Jesus that they have a question for him. But before they even ask their question, they come to him and they say, "Teacher, we want you to give us whatever it is that we want." That's a question like a child would ask. They don't say what they want. They say, "We want you to give us whatever we want," before he even knows what it is. This is like that moment, ladies, when your husband comes in and says, "I have something to tell you, but you have to promise you can't be mad at me." It's an impossible promise to kind of make because you have no idea what's coming on the other end of that promise, and you might have a right to be mad at them for whatever they would confess in that moment. You know, this is kind of like the request that James and John make to Jesus. "We have a question, God. We want you to give us, Lord, we want you to give us what we want." And so Jesus doesn't acknowledge and say, "Yes, I would love to." He says kind of, "What is the question that you have for me?" He doesn't give into that. And they say, "We want you to seat us at your right and left hand in the kingdom as you rule over." That's the request that they come and they make to Jesus. And as, you know, they're literally saying to Jesus, "We want to be your right and left hand guys. We want to be the people who are ruling alongside of you. We see ourselves," this is what they're saying, "we see ourselves as just second to you in the rulers over all of creation. We see ourselves as over the rest of these disciples. We see ourselves as over the rest of your followers. We see ourselves as over the rest of people on earth. When you rule, we want to be right there on your right and left hand side." And as you can imagine, this request does not sit well with the other 10 disciples. And so to pick it up in Mark chapter 10, verse 41, we begin reading this. "When the 10 heard about this, they became indignant with James and John. Jesus called them together and said, 'You know that those who are regarded as rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them. Not so with you. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant, and whoever wants to be first must be slave of all. For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many." And so in this passage, what Jesus talks about is that he says, look, if you look at the world around you, what you see is this. If you look at the Gentiles, you see that the people who are rulers over the Gentiles, they lord it over the people who are under them. They kind of hold it over them that they're the people who are in charge. They're underneath them. And then it says that they exercise that authority over them. They control them. So he says, in the outside world, outside of the kingdom that Jesus is coming to establish, it says that people in positions of authority lord it over people who are underneath them and they control them. And that is kind of the way that submission is oftentimes played out in the world outside of the kingdom of God. But he says in the kingdom that he's coming to establish, submission is something, or ruling over people is something that looks very different. Again, to read starting in verse 43, he says, "Not so with you. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant. And whoever wants to be first must be slave of all. For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. This is the way that Jesus explains what it means to submit to one another. This is the way that Jesus explains what it means to even be in a position of authority over one another. He talks about the idea of serving one another. He talks about the idea, he even uses the term being a slave to other people in saying that people who are going to be elevated are people who are actively looking for ways that they can be serving the people who are underneath of them. And we see Jesus not only say this in his words, but demonstrate this. You know, the way the passage ends, it says that he's offering up his life as a ransom for many. But we see throughout the ministry of Jesus, we see him care for people who were considered lowly, whose society had disregarded. When it comes to his disciples, we see Jesus get down and wash the feet of his disciples, a role that maybe they would have done for themselves, but that typically would be reserved for a servant or a slave when they walked into a house. We see Jesus live out this idea of becoming a servant or a slave to people. And then ultimately, in his death and resurrection on the cross, we see the way that Jesus literally laid down his life as a ransom for many. And so what we read in this passage is that the idea of submitting to one another is not something that Jesus says diminishes our value. Jesus does not devalue the person who submits. Jesus does not equate submission with weakness or equate submission with being less than another person. He says that's what the outside world does outside of his kingdom. Jesus does not say that submission is only the role for a woman or for a wife. Jesus makes it clear that in acting out his kingship on earth, he did so by serving and submitting his life as a sacrifice for others. And one of the foundational elements of a healthy family is the notion of mutual submission. And so this applies to husbands, this applies to wives, this applies to children, this applies to siblings. By using himself as an example and kind of lifting up the way he lived as the example, Jesus makes it clear that submission to one another is not a matter of weakness, that it's a good thing that we practice. It's our culture where we have a self-inflated kind of sense of importance, or our culture outside of the kingdom of God that illustrates all of these unhealthy ways in which authority is lorded over people who are underneath, that you get this idea that submission is a bad thing. That's not the way that Jesus paints the idea of submission. And as we think about remodeling our homes, as we think about fixing up our families, the notion of mutual submission, as Paul talks about and advocates for in Ephesians 5:21, is something that is one of those essential foundational elements of a Christian home. There are lots of things that make our homes enjoyable, but they aren't foundational. You know, if any of you have ever been stayed in a house before that didn't have indoor plumbing, you know that it is enjoyable to have indoor plumbing. I used to stay at this little cabin, this fishing cabin in Elk County, and it had cold water that would run from a spring through the tap, but it didn't have any indoor plumbing as far as going to the bathroom. There was an outhouse in the backyard. It didn't have any hot water. It didn't have any shower. It didn't have any of those kinds of amenities of indoor plumbing except for a sink that could get you some water. That house had been standing for a long time without indoor plumbing. It wasn't a necessity to make the house stand. If any of you have been in a house or live in a house right now without a dishwasher like we do, you know that process is inconvenient at times. You know, Becca and I have talked, when we dream about the kitchen remodel project, certainly a dishwasher is a foundational element to that project. It's something that we have said we probably would look to, you know, as an important piece when we go to purchase our next home. Though I've tried to say to Becca that, you know, when we purchase our next home, we should have two dishwashers named Weston and Zeke at that point, who should be able to do an adequate job. I don't know if that's, I don't know if she's bought that or not. But certainly a home can stand for a long, long time without a dishwasher. It's a convenience. It's an important thing. It's a good thing if you can have it, but it's not something that is going to affect whether or not your house stands or doesn't stand. We've all been in homes that have, you know, that need a lot of help in interior decorating, you know, that have either, you know, an awful combination of carpet and walls, or just a bad color of paint on the walls that can sometimes make you feel uncomfortable even to be in a room, you know, or just awful, really old, out of date, kind of bad looking wallpaper, or things like, you know, there are any number of things you could point at in interior decorating, that might not be ideal about a house. But I promise this, that old fabric fuzzy wallpaper will never, ever make a house fall over. The way a house looks on the inside, the way a wall is painted or carpet that's down, it just isn't going to make a house fall down. But a weak foundation, a weak system underneath your family can do that. It can affect the physical home that you're living in, and it can absolutely undermine the relationships that exist inside your home. If you don't have a strong foundation, your home can fall. And so this idea of submitting and serving to one another out of reverence for Christ is something that's so important, because it is foundational. And we see that it's foundational. We see its importance in the way that Jesus uses the marriage relationship, uses this idea, and the example he has for it is the relationship between himself and the church. It's of that level of importance to him, that it's on par with being between himself and the church. That's how he describes the marriage relationship. And if we would go on reading in verse 25, as he talks about the role of husbands, he says, "Husbands, love your wives just as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her." When you read through the entirety of chapter 5, which I would recommend, you see Paul use the way Jesus interacts with the church to describe how we should interact in human marriages. We saw the way that in the passage to wives, where it talks about how Christ is the head, or how the husband is the head over the family, in the same way Christ is the head over the church. We see in this passage how husbands are supposed to love themselves in that same sacrificial way that Christ did in giving up his life for us. That's how husbands are supposed to love their wives. It's this idea that is very important to the marriage relationship. This idea that's very important to the homes that we live in. And it transcends even just the marriage relationship. And that idea of mutual submission is something that affects the entire family. Husbands, wives, kids, parents. It's important across the board. It's something that Paul doesn't assign to a specific group of people. He assigns it to believers. And so in light of this idea, I want to ask you to do two things every day this week. The first is this. I would ask you to take a moment to pray and to ask God how you can serve your family. This is for husbands, for wives, for kids, for parents. To take a moment to pray and ask God how you can serve your family. And there are some of us, that we often say this, you know, I felt like I spent time praying and thinking about this and just nothing came to mind. If you're in that boat, the second piece will help you. Because the second thing I want you to do every day this week, that I would encourage you to do every day this week, is to ask how you can help. To go to the people who are in your family and ask them how you can help. I once heard a very wise person kind of speak on this passage in Ephesians chapter 5. And he said that one of the key applications to this passage, one of the key ways that we can walk away with some tangible wisdom from this passage, is if we walk away from it and we say to our spouses, to our kids, to our parents, we just simply ask them, how can I help you? What can I do to help you today? What can I do to serve you today? What's a way, what's something that you have going on in your life that you need help with, that I can be a part of today? And I don't do this often from the front. But I will make a promise to you that if every day this week you prayed and asked God how to help your family, and then you went to your spouse and your kids or your parents and you asked them how you could help them today, that by this time next week you'll have a better marriage. That by this time next week you'll have a better family. And I'm not saying that your family's bad right now. You might have an incredible family right now and an incredible family situation right now. But if you took this idea to heart and every day this week you asked your spouse or your kids what you could do to help them, it would change the dynamics of your family. If you get in the car and you do that on the way home today, your spouse might say to you, "You're only doing that because of church today." And then you'll say, "Yeah, but I really want to know how to help you." And when they give you something and you follow through and help them, it will make your life better. It will help to remodel your life immediately right now where you're at. If when you come home this week and, you know, everyone has different family dynamics, if you're the husband and you're home from work earlier and you normally start making dinner, or if you're the wife and you're the one who's the cook and you start making dinner, and the other person, if you walk in and you see that dinner isn't started yet or isn't made yet, instead of asking the question, "Why isn't dinner started yet?" it would be better if you asked the question, "How can I help you?" when you walked in the door. As you see your spouse working on some kind of project, whether it's cleaning or folding laundry or washing dishes or doing something, and it could be anything, weeding in the garden, and you're reading a book, if you put down the book for a minute on your own and asked how you can help, that would do worlds of help in your home. Instead of just assuming that if your spouse needs help, you take the initiative and you ask them how you can help, it will immediately improve your marriage and your home situation. It will immediately improve the living situation that you find yourself in by proactively looking to help others instead of waiting for them to ask it for you. I promise that you will grow closer, that your bond will improve, that you'll be growing stronger as you seek to serve each other. And this doesn't just work with husbands and wives. This would absolutely be true with your relationship with your kids. When you're picking them up from school or when they're coming home from school and you're talking around the dinner table, you know, any kind of situation where you have a minute to talk with your kids, if you ask them what you could do to help them in the situation where they're at and just let them describe it to you, it would improve the relationship that you have with your kids. It would help you guys to grow a bond that's closer to each other. It would help you to be stronger and more honest in the relationship that you have with each other, because parenting is hard. You have the hard role of both unconditionally loving your kids and at the same time oftentimes being the one who's correcting them and teaching them and sometimes unpleasantly teaching them lessons about the way that life works and the way that they're going to live. It's a hard role to be in both of those situations, but if you take this idea of loving and serving your kids, it will improve the bond that you have with them. And kids, if you walked in and you said to your parents, "What can I do to help you today?" they might not be able to verbalize a response. Their gums would flap and their jaw would drop and you would get to do whatever you wanted anyway. But the idea that you walk in the door and you would say, "Hey, what can I do to help you today?" it would, I mean, your parents, like Chip talked about, your parents, if their friends ever overheard that, they would think, "Can you please write a book or have a seminar on parenting? You clearly have something good. You clearly have something figured out here in what you're doing." If you had a relationship like that, it would affect your family immediately if you started asking the question, "How can I help you?" instead of waiting for someone to ask for help. I promise you that that would happen. And this is the kind of dynamic of serving and loving one another that Jesus sets up as an example for us in all areas of life, but specifically as Paul talks about this idea in the family. And as we seek to remodel our families, as we seek to fix things in our families that might be broken, This idea of asking how we can be helpful in observing one another is a way that we can live out what Jesus says will be the thing that makes us great in the kingdom of God. Will be the thing that ironically, that as we lower ourselves, it really lifts us up. So I would encourage you this week to ask that question in your prayers and to ask that question to your families.